Welcome to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm your host, Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm here every Wednesday evening from 6 to 7 p.m. talking with authors, editors, agents, and poets about writing. Tonight I have two guests. My guest for the first half of the show is Stephen Malk, a San Diego literary agent for the author's books, and my guest for the second half of the show will be Janelle Cannon, author of Stella Luna. Steve Malk grew up around children's books, literally. His mother, Susan Malk, owns the well-known White Rabbit Children's Books in La Jolla, and his grandmother, Sylvia Klugman, owned the children's bookstore in Johannesburg, South Africa, which, when it opened its doors in 1952, was one of the first children's bookstores in the world. After working at the White Rabbit through high school and college, Malk worked as an agent with the Sandra Dykstra Literary Agency for almost 4 years. He left the Dykstra Agency to open a West Coast office for Writer's House, where he specializes in children's books and young adult literature. Malk also represents adult authors whose work ranges from literary fiction to narrative nonfiction and serious nonfiction. Are you there, Steve?
Yeah.
Great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Tell me, how did you, I mean, I know you became a children's book agent and from your experience, but, you know, it's unusual to be an agent of children's books, isn't it? Authors of children's books.
Right. It is. I mean, it's definitely a specialty. The reason I went into it is because I am actually a third-generation children's book person. My mother owns a children's book store in La Jolla, which is a pretty well-known store called the White Rabbit.
Mm-hmm.
And my grandmother actually started one of the first children's bookstores in the world in 1952 in South Africa. And so it was actually pretty natural. And I worked at the White Rabbit for about 6 years. So that was just a really fabulous foundation for what I do.
And had you ever been stationed in New York, or have you been in San Diego since you've begun doing agenting on your own?
Yeah, I really have. You know, I worked for a different agency before, which is based here, the Sandra Dykstra Agency. And now that I'm with Writer's House, they are based in New York. They're a fairly large agency based in New York. And, you know, I do go back there and see editors and spend some time in their office. So it actually works out really well.
Mm-hmm. What is publishing like today versus when you began? Is it tons harder to get new authors' work out there, or has it always been difficult?
I don't know if it's harder. I think it's more competitive. I think publishers, it's been pretty well documented. I mean, publishing has changed, and I think it's gotten more competitive, and I think there are less slots, and I think publishers are looking for bigger books, quote-unquote, and, you know, the mid-list titles, the mid-list is kind of dying. So I think it's more competitive, and I think at the same time, as the lists are kind of shrinking, more agents are popping up.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's more people competing for fewer spots, and I definitely think, you know, more people than ever are writing, and I think that's a great thing. And so I don't have any problem getting material, but I do try to be pretty selective.
Do authors tend to come after you, or do you ever go after authors?
I'd say for the most part, they solicit me. Either through referrals from other authors, or they hear me speak, read about me somewhere, whatnot, or in a guide. You know, occasionally, if I see something that I really like in a magazine or wherever, I just see a book in a store and I don't think they're agents, that I'll go after them. Doesn't happen that often, but, you know, I don't have any prejudice against that. I'd certainly, if I see something I really like and they don't have an agent, I'll go after it. But for the most part, people usually solicit me.
What kind of material do you really like?
As far as children's books?
Yeah. Are there certain types of books? Are they more narrative? Are they more pictorial?
You know, it depends. I mean, I represent a really wide range of books for kids, and it's hard to pinpoint it exactly. I think I look for stuff that has a really strong voice, and people might think that's strange. Usually when you think of voice, you think of a big adult novel, but children's books, a good children's book has just as strong of a voice, and the kind of voice I look for, it can be anything from, you know, really funny to sad to haunting to just extremely well written.
Mm-hmm.
But in whatever it is, I think look for books that stay with me, you know, days later, books that I'm still thinking about and that I can't really get out of my head. I just really try to, because the market is competitive, I try to take on stuff that I just can't say no to,
mm-hmm.
and that really stays with me.
Name a few titles that you feel have a strong voice and that sort of represent what you're talking about.
Well, I mean, as far as novels, and these aren't my books, but I'm just going to give you some mm-hmm. novels that are out there that I think would be good examples for people. I think anything written by Katherine Patterson, she wrote Bridge to Terabithia and Jacob Have I Loved, she's won a couple of Newbery medals, is great. And I think Karen Cushman, who's recently won a couple Newbery medals herself, is also really good. A couple of her books are Catherine Called Birdie and The Midwife's Apprentice. Actually, the book that won the Newbery medal this last year called Holes by Lewis Sachar, S-A-C-H-A-R, is a great example as well. So I really like their work. As far as picture books go, books for younger kids, I've always been a big fan of Peggy Rathman's. She wrote a book called Goodnight Gorilla and a book mm-hmm. called Officer Buckle and Gloria. I've always liked Kevin Hanks, who also writes novels, actually. He has a book that came out about 2 years ago that's done really well called Lily's Plastic Purple Purse. And
mm-hmm.
I've always been a big fan of Barbara Cooney, who's pretty old now, but she has done a number of books. Miss Rumphius is one of her books. She did a book I love called Emily, which is actually about Emily Dickinson. So I'm a big fan of hers as well. And I think all of those people, and it's lots of different ways. I mean, some of those books are serious, some aren't. But I think the thing they have in common is a really strong voice and something that makes them stand out.
When authors contact you, do you like them to send along illustrations or not? This is a question I hear often.
Yeah, I hear it too. If they have written a manuscript for a picture book and they don't illustrate, it's fine, and they should just send the manuscript, and I'll sell it to a publisher, and then a publisher will find an illustrator. So an author can actually shoot themselves in the foot if they send in, you know, stick figure illustrations or something,
right.
or if they try to do it themselves, which a lot of people do, or they go and, you know, the neighbor down the street illustrates. And so you have to be careful when you send in illustrations. It's better if you don't illustrate. It's just better to let the publisher take care of it, which happens 9 times out of 10.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm talking with Steve Malk, who's an agent with Writer's House, which is based in New York, and he's in San Diego. So in terms of sending in material, do you like them to send in the manuscript, or would you prefer a query letter?
I prefer the manuscript.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that, you know, with query letters, it's kind of hard to tell. I just kind of like to skip that step. So I just prefer that someone goes ahead and sends it to me.
Is it worth it for an author to, say, pay a really hot illustrator, or does it really stand on the text?
It completely stands on the text,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, the illustrations. I mean, they have to work together. So if someone has, if their text is not that great and they find a wonderful illustrator, it's not going to make me take it on.
Mm-hmm.
They both have to work together. So I think, you know, the best picture books have a really good balance between text and illustration.
Mm-hmm.
And they can both work independently and with each other as well.
Mm-hmm. When you take on an author, is there a typical amount of time that it takes to sell a project before? Well, first of all, that's the first part of the question.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second part is, does there come a point if you don't sell the book that you decide, you know, it's not going to sell and you're going to give up on it or you know?
Right. Well, usually it varies in terms of how long it takes me to sell something. It's taken me 24 hours before. Other times it's been a longer haul. It just varies. I mean, I think especially in the children's market, I'm known as being pretty aggressive, so I'd say my response times are pretty good based on what's normal. In terms of how long I stick with something, like I said, I'm very careful about what I take on. I really put a lot of thought into it, and I take on stuff that I really love. It sometimes isn't necessarily the most marketable idea, but it's something that I really love and that I feel should be published. And given that, I will stick with it basically to the end.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, there have been books I've been able to sell, but I can say that I've made a really, really strong effort for them and pretty much show them to everyone I can. Mm-hmm. And I'll usually pretty much always stick with that author, you know, past that book. It might just be that the first book doesn't sell and then the second one does, which has happened. I had an author approach me last year with a project that I really loved that was actually a novel, and I couldn't sell it. But and in the meantime, she wrote a picture book, and I subsequently sold 4 picture books. Mm-hmm. So that novel still isn't sold, but she sold 4 picture books mm-hmm. in the last 6 months. So
interesting. How involved in the editing do you get?
I get pretty involved. I think these days most agents have to sort of act as editors as well, just because when you send something out to an editor, you want it to be pretty polished. So when someone sends something in to me, if I like it but I think it needs work, I'll make editorial suggestions and try to get it in pretty good shape. And then once it's sold to a publisher, I like to keep my eyes on what's happening and just make sure that the editing's going smoothly. I by no means get in the way of the editor-author relationship, which is a really valuable relationship unto itself. But I do just like to make sure things are going smoothly.
Mm-hmm. Getting back to what you just said a few minutes ago, when you take on an author, are you looking at the big picture? Are you looking at not just this book, but does this author have other books in him or her?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's true of almost any agent. And even I think that goes beyond just children's books. But certainly I am looking at the big picture. And I'm really interested in working with people who you know, really are passionate about writing children's books and see it as something they want to be doing for a long time and will write many more. You know, I'm not as interested in working with someone who wrote a children's book in 5 minutes at the bus stop. You know, I'm interested in people who do it because they really love it and they want to keep doing it and they're not doing it to make a lot of money. I mean, that can happen, but they're doing it because they're passionate about doing it.
So would that be a part of the discussion you might have with an author before you take them on?
Well, I always try to get a feel for an author. I'm not going to quiz them and say, you know, tell me your next 10 books. They don't necessarily have to have them in mind, but I can get a feel for whether they're serious about the field and it's something that they want to keep pursuing. Mm-hmm. And the nice thing about children's books is that you can write quite a few in a pretty short period of time. I have an author I took on a little over a year ago, and I've sold 7 of her books.
Mm.
So, and 2 of them are novels.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not to say it's easy or quick to write a children's book, because it is not. That's a common misconception. But, yeah, I do always have a discussion and try to get a feel for kind of what they're planning.
So if an author you take on writes children's books, loves to write children's books, but also works on, nonfiction books or adult novels, will you still take them on, or will you sort of partner with another agent with that client?
I would take them on if I really liked the children's books.
Mm-hmm.
There are quite a few people who do that. I myself represent adult books as well, so I can actually do both, which is pretty useful because there's a lot of adult agents who don't do children's books. I do both. If it was something I wasn't interested in, because there are certain types of adult books I'm not as interested in, I could partner with another agent. I have done that before. And the great thing about Writer's House is that it's a big agency, and there's a lot of agents there who do all types of different books, so I could always partner with someone there.
Mm-hmm. Describe your dream client.
Gosh, my dream client.
Call you at 3 in the morning.
Right. No, I think the type of people who I like to work with, and I think I can honestly say I do have a lot of those clients, are people who, as I say, really, really love children's books. Because, as I said before, I think it's a really common misconception. A lot of people are snotty about children's books and think it's easy to do and I can sit down for 5 minutes and what's the big deal? You know, there's only 300 words. But I'm really looking for people who are really serious about it, are doing it because they want to do it, and would be doing it whether they were making any money out of it or not. It's just something they're drawn to. They read what's out there. And I guess their work has a really good, strong voice.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I also like to represent stuff that's timeless. So hopefully it's work that is going to be around for a long time. I don't tend to represent projects because I hear, you know, this is hot. I just represent stuff that I like and it stays with me. It doesn't matter if it's quote-unquote, hot at the moment or not.
How much does instinct play a part in choosing authors that do sell and continue to write good books.
Mm-hmm. Well, instinct plays a huge part in my decisions. I can't speak for other agents. I mean, I think ultimately at the end of the day, everyone goes on their instincts, but for me, it's really a big part of my decision. I think because of 6 years of experience at a children's bookstore, I got a good feel for what I like and what I don't like, and I have strong instincts. So if I get something and I like it, I go with it. And I've literally gotten stuff and read it once and called the author up and asked to represent them and sold the book right away. Mm-hmm. So for me, it plays a very strong role. I mean, I don't get something and then try to figure out what niche it's going to fall into and try to figure out if that's a trend in the market. And I guess there's nothing wrong with doing that. It's just not the way I work.
What about rhyming? I noticed that, you know, in the books that I read to Travis, my four-year-old, many of the books do not rhyme, and the few that do are just excellent.
Yeah, that's right. Rhyming is really tricky. A lot of people who start writing children's books assume it should be in rhyme because, well, for a lot of people, their frame of reference is Dr. Seuss.
Mm-hmm.
And rhyme, as you just said, really well. When it works really well, and when it doesn't work, it's usually pretty awful. So I think you just have to be careful. I mean, I don't think people should think that they have to write in rhyme to write a children's book. I mean, you certainly don't. And if you are trying to write in rhyme, you just need to keep in mind that the rhyme needs to serve a purpose. It should be there for a reason. You should be rhyming for a reason, and you shouldn't be. And the biggest problem with rhyme is that you start inevitably reaching for a word.
Mm-hmm.
And that shouldn't be there. So that is probably the most common mistake I see. And a lot of the manuscripts I get are in rhyme, the picture books. I mean, I'd say as high as 50 or 60%.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I've definitely sold some really good rhyming manuscripts, but it's a tough thing to do.
How many submissions do you get, say, in a month?
Gosh, it's hard for me to quantify it. I mean, I'm not exactly sure. I mean, probably somewhere around 100.
Mm-hmm.
That's just off the top of my head. I'm not sure.
And then what percentage of that might be authors that you sign or at least are interested in and want to see more, want to have a conversation?
It's pretty low.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as I said, I try to be really selective. And the people who I take on, I like to give a lot of attention to. So I'm not really interested in just taking on a lot of people and trying to throw a lot of stuff out there. I think my success rate's really high. So as a result, I'm picky, and I'd say the percentage is pretty low. But it doesn't mean that I'm not open.
Right.
I definitely am.
Are there certain faux pas that authers make when they submit to you that you'd like to caution everybody in the world about?
Yeah. You need to be professional, and you need to do your homework. So when you approach me or any other agent, you need to write type, I should say, a good cover letter. I mean, I'll get cover letters now and then that are scribbled in pencil. You know, you need to type a good cover letter without any grammatical errors or misspellings. And definitely, I'd say the biggest faux pas is people who don't include an SASC. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just industry standard. And if you don't include an SASC, you're just not going to hear back. And I think that goes for me or any other agent. So I think you need to look at the writer's guides, join groups, and just do your homework and approach people the right way.
So if you were to, when you get one of those handwritten letters, does that stop you from looking further? Or if you looked further and saw the material as just being splendid, would it matter?
Well, yeah, it's not like I'm going to just throw it out because it's in pencil, but I think it doesn't exactly predispose me to liking the manuscript.
Yes.
And it raises certain questions in my mind about the author. I mean, it's different. I mean, there are circumstances where maybe someone doesn't own a computer or a typewriter. But, you know, if someone sends me something that's misspelled and with my name misspelled and all this kind of stuff, it's just not going to predispose you to liking the manuscript.
Mm-hmm. What qualities in an agent do you think a writer should look for?
Well, I think that's a really good question. And I think a writer really should do their research when they get an agent. When they approach an agent, you shouldn't just send your work out blindly to X agent. I think you need to find someone who you really trust and who you understand and who you feel you share a common vision with.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's very important that you and your agent see your career taking shape in the same way. I think you need to approve of your agent's style. I mean, all agents are different. Some are really aggressive. Some are a little more laid back. Some focus on one thing and not the other. See, I think you, before a writer approaches an agent, they need to sit down and say, you know, what kind of agent do I really want? And then try to find someone who's a good fit.
So they should say that and not just, I'll take the first one who,
right.
who
you,
wants
you,
me.
Yeah, you hear these bad agent stories. And, you know, I'm not the right agent for everyone. No one is. So you just need to know kind of what you're looking for. And I'd say ultimately, though, your agent should be, obviously have a really strong knowledge of the marketplace and, you know, be able to place your work not just with a publisher, but with the right publisher and the right editor for you.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you want someone who loves your work, and that's probably the most important thing. You need someone who really, really loves your work and who's going to be passionate about it, and, you know, because that passion is going to translate when they're talking to editors. And if, for whatever reason, it doesn't sell right away, I think if your agent really loves it, they'll stick with it, and their enthusiasm won't wane.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you need to find someone who ultimately really loves your work.
What is one myth or 10 myths writers have about agents that you'd like to undo right now?
Well, I think one is that agents, you know, sit in their offices all day and leisurely read manuscripts while sipping tea. Agents just don't do that. And most agents and editors, I don't even think, read at the office at all. It's pretty much all done after work and on weekends. You know, during the day, we're working for our authors. So, you know, when people call and just want to basically talk shop and ask for a lot of advice, you have to realize that during the day, agents are working for their clients who they already represent.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's just one that leaps to mind. but I'm sure there's a lot of other ones.
Do you want to tell listeners how to find you?
Sure. Well, one way to find me, actually, I'm going to be at a conference, and some people listening to your show, I'm sure, are familiar with the organization SCBWI, which is the Society of Children's Book Writers and Illustrators,
mm-hmm.
and it's a great organization. And it's a great way to get into children's books. And even if you're in it and established, it's still a good organization. And they're having their national conference in Los Angeles and Century City from August 7th to 10th. And I'll be speaking there. I'll be on an agents panel on Tuesday the 10th. And that's at the Century Plaza Hotel. But if you do want to contact me, the best thing to do is to write me and include an SASE. And my name is Stephen with a V, not a PH, M-A-L-K. And the agency is Writers House, no apostrophe with Writers. And the address is 3368 3368 Governor, just normal spelling of Governor, Drive, number 224F, like Frank, 224F. And that's in San Diego. And the zip code is 92122.
Great. And, you know, conferences, sounds like you think they're a good idea for writers to go there and meet agents and learn about the industry.
Great. They really are, you know, especially this one, but any regional conferences or whatnot, it's just a good way to, as you say, meet agents, meet editors, meet other writers, network, you know, really learn and just try to soak up as much information as you can.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really good, it's something all authors should do, even if you've been well-published, I think.
And any last words for writers who are listening?
Well, I think my last words would just be that I think it's a really good time in children's books right now. Something I should have said earlier that you may be aware of, or I think certainly people who aren't even up on the children's market are aware of, is that there are the series of books called Harry Potter. Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone was the first one, and they came out of England. And these aren't my books, so I'm not hyping my books. But they're published by Scholastic here, and the first two have been published, and they're both in the top five on the New York Times adult hardcover bestseller mm-hmm. list. And the first one's gone over 1 million copies, I believe. And these are children's books. They're fantasy novels. So I think, and the, you know, the movie rights were sold for over $1 million. So, you know, it's a good time for children's books, definitely. And it just shows that a good children's book can transcend that market and do really well. So I think it's a positive time.
Well, I sure appreciate having you on.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
Thank you so much.
Okay, take care.
Uh-huh.
Bye.
Bye-bye. That was Steve Malk. He is an agent with Writer's House, and we're going to take a short break, and when we return, we will have Janelle Cannon, author of Stella Luna, with us. Stay tuned. Hello, I am back, and I am here with Janelle Cannon, author of Stella Luna. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. This is Writers on Writing, and we're here every week from 6 to 7. Usually I have one author on the whole entire show, but I'm doing some things a little different, and I thought it would be great to pair up Steve Malk with Janelle Cannon. So let's see if she's there. Are you there, Janelle? Are you there?
Yes.
Great. Great to have you. Janelle Cannon is the author of three children's books. In 1993, Stella Luna was published. In 1995, Trupp was published. And in 1997, Verdi. Tell me the story of how you got Stella Luna published.
It was mainly driven by wanting to create a body of work that I could focus on singly and something I could be very proud of. And the book just gradually, slowly came together in image and writing over about 1.5 to 2 years. And then I realized I had a book on my hands, and then I began to think about publishing it. I had heard of Sandra Dykstra, who works out of Del Mar, and I thought, oh, it would be wonderful to work with a West Coast agent.
Mm-hmm.
And she has a wonderful reputation and has a lot of clout for the West Coast. Most of the publishing, as you know, centers in New York.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, I will approach her, start at the top and work my way down. And so I created a query letter, a synopsis of the story, and sent some color copies of the art.
Mm-hmm.
And much to my surprise, she responded very quickly and accepted me as a client.
And I think Stella Luna is perhaps the only children's book, or you as a children's book author, are the only, well, maybe one of two clients she has who writes children's books, and I think the other is Amy Tan,
yes,
who wrote a children's book.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It was sheer dumb luck that I approached her at the moment that she was taking interest in children's books.
Mm-hmm. So, and how did Stella Luna come about? It's the story of a bat.
Yes. Many, many things went into the story. It's full of layers, but there's a couple of, larger influences that went into it. I've traveled in various countries, and one thing I noticed, especially in Thailand, I felt at once very at home and at ease with everybody there, but I couldn't speak the language, and I was missing cultural context. And so it was a paradoxical feeling that led me to ask the question that ended up in Stella Luna, is how can we feel so different and be so much the same? And how can we be so different and feel so much the same?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, wow, that would be a very interesting question to ask of children. And instead of approaching differences and, with a judgmental attitude, just to ponder the question and the phenomenon of differences, and also to be careful about assuming sameness. You can run into as much trouble assuming people are the same as assuming that they're different. So there's a balance there that I felt was important pose the question about. So that was a large part of what I wanted to convey in the story. And choosing a bat, I've always loved all species of animals, and I especially enjoy the ones that, are more mysterious, lesser known, and usually people tend to shy away from them, bats in particular. But I thought, well, with this sort of a theme of contrasts and differences, the bat would be a wonderful creature to carry that story, being nocturnal and hanging by its feet and things that we feel are opposite of our ways.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, when I was dreaming up this whole idea, I stumbled upon a National Geographic feature that featured a bat, the Gambian epauletted fruit bat. And it was the most beautiful bat I'd ever seen. I thought, that's my model. People need to see this creature. And I felt if I drew, you know, this bat realistically and then was able to, you know, lead people and children in particular to, you know, appreciate the wide variety of bats in the world, you know, as well as, you know, carrying some of these questions in the story, I felt that, you know, it all kind of just fell together.
Would you read a bit?
Sure. Sure, I will start.
Then you're going to read from Stella Luna.
Yes. All right, here we go. In a warm and sultry forest far, far away, there once lived a mother fruit bat and her new baby. Oh, how mother bat loved her soft, tiny baby. I'll name you Stella Luna, she crooned. Each night, mother bat would carry Stella Luna clutched to her breast as she flew out to search for food. But one night, as mother bat followed the heavy scent of ripe fruit, an owl spied her. On silent wings, the powerful bird swooped down upon the bat. Dodging and shrieking, Mother Bat tried to escape, but the owl struck again and again, knocking Stella Luna into the air. Her baby wings were as limp and useless as wet paper. Down, down she went, faster and faster, into the forest below. The dark, leafy tangle of branches caught Stella Luna as she fell. One twig was small enough for Stella Luna's tiny feet. Wrapping her wings about her, she clutched the thin branch, trembling with cold and fear. Mother, Stella Luna squeaked, where are you? By daybreak, the baby bat could hold on no longer. Down, down again, she dropped. There's the cliffhanger.
It's a wonderful book. We love Stella Luna. You're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm talking with Janelle Cannon, author of Stella Luna and Trup and Verdi. How long does it take you to write and illustrate a book?
Once I have my concept fixed in my mind and I've had discussions with my publisher, I usually can finish a book within about 6 to 8 months.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the time is spent on the art. I use a very detailed technique with colored pencil and airbrush, and it's very time-consuming. But I've kept my work small in order to be able to work, I average about 20 to 22 color illustrations per book.
Mm-hmm. So you use airbrush. The technique is interesting. The art is so interesting. I look at these pictures and wonder how you did it. And now you're telling me, and this is great.
Yeah. Well, the Prismacolor pencils I use are glorious. They come in 120 different colors. The ultimate Crayola kit.
So it sounds like you were an artist first and a writer second?
Yes.
Yeah.
Illustration comes most easily to me, and when I'm thinking up the stories, they appear to me more in a visual form, much like a storyboard in creating a movie. And I see these things very clearly. The creatures are animated. I watch what they're doing, and I'm taking notes because oftentimes I don't know until I watch long enough, you know, what's going on, and then the story begins to take form.
So with Stella Luna, or say any of your books, the pictures came first and then you told the story, or were you imagining what the story, well, I would imagine you're thinking of what the story is, and then, and representing that visually, and then later put it to words?
Yeah, it's hard to define because there's many things going on at once. I do, you know, as I said, when I was traveling, I had the paradoxical question in my mind, and I thought, how would I convey that?
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, in searching magazines and such, I found this wonderful bat, and then I had, you know, several other images in my mind and what would happen, and I would sketch things out on napkins while I was eating breakfast somewhere, and gradually, bit by bit, the imagery, that would form first, and then I began to work with the text and to make it, you know, coincide with the images. Oftentimes I sit in the tub and write. That's my favorite place to concentrate. I can't get up and do anything else. And
that's true.
Be disciplined. But then I go on to the computer and type in the text and begin an editing process.
Are you surprised with how roaringly successful Stella Luna became?
Absolutely. My image, while I was working at my job, my expectation was to work many, many more years at the job while producing books. I had set sort of a tentative plan of having maybe 5-6 books out there doing okay, and perhaps then I might leave my job. But this first book just took off and beyond my expectations, and things happened much faster than I'd ever imagined. And it's a delight because I love what I do. Now, I did leave my 9-to-5 job, and I've developed a very nocturnal schedule now with my illustration, and it's fantastic.
One thing I like about Stella Luna is, you know, I think bats are given a bad rap. I think they're wonderful creatures, and they do so much good for the environment and pollinating plants and all sorts of things. And I really like that aspect of the book, that I felt that you're really helping the case for, you know, the positive aspects of bats. And I wonder if you intended to do that.
Yes. Long before I published Stella Luna, I was a card-carrying member of Bat Conservation International.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's a group that's headquartered in Austin, Texas. And in fact, the president of that organization, Merlin Tuttle, is the author of the National Geographic article that got me
mm-hmm.
going on the fruit bats. So I've, you know, been a bat fan for many, many years. And all species, they have their place.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my favorite definitions of how we look at animals, my definition of vermin is any species that effectively competes with us. Look at the rodents, the mice, rats, seagulls, any effective, you know, the cockroaches,
mm-hmm.
which is the subject of my new book.
Oh, and when does that come out?
Fall of 2000.
Fall of 2000?
Yes.
We must wait more than a year?
Well, it'll be upon us quickly. Yeah.
Do you have... No, go ahead.
Oh, well, once I get finished with a piece, with picture books, the production takes a long time, and it could go on for nearly a year.
What does it entail?
And
what is your involvement in that process?
Well, it goes into the design groups at the publisher. People get together, art directors, designers, and begin the very detailed process of making decisions on everything from the design of a border to the type of font. Every little decision, it's just minutiae involved in putting together a book. Once that's set, then the design goes on into a printing process, and that once we get all the decisions made, it goes overseas, and printing proofs begin to circulate amongst the designers and myself, and we check for color and make absolutely sure we do like the design decisions. And oftentimes it will go through a first proof, second proof, maybe third. It depends.
And is that making sure that the colors and such are what you originally drew the images in?
Yes, trying to get the printing as close to the original art as
mm-hmm.
possible.
Mm-hmm.
And they have amazing people on the staff at Harcourt that have a very good eye.
mm-hmm.
And so it's been a lot of fun learning the production process. And once the proofs are finally approved, the book goes into a folded and gathered state, or F&Gs, and that's where the book is actually assembled completely except for binding. And everybody gives it the once-over again, and then it goes into the binding process.
Mm-hmm.
But it takes a long time, each stage, and the publishers are also working with several other books so that they're juggling a lot of projects at once. So these things don't just fly through. Zillions of decisions to be made for each book.
Do you have a bat house?
I do.
Do you? Oh, that's great.
I just moved, though, and I put one up in the yard where I used to live, and it just wasn't suitable. Nobody moved in, and I just realized bats are, very picky about the conditions of their houses and safety. And, I didn't have a jacuzzi in there, but so I took the house down, and I'm looking for good places on this new site, knowing more than what I knew before. Hopefully, I'll get some residents.
Interesting. So, will bats take up residence in say a metropolitan area, or do you have to be more in the country?
Oh yeah, yeah. In several of the beach towns here, a lot of the old buildings, the old tile roofs, bats love to wedge up into the tiles there, and for the daytime sleep. And oftentimes, when buildings get remodeled, they will discover fairly large colonies of bats.
Hmm.
And fortunately, in our local area, we've had bat conservation groups do controlled removal of the bats, and then they build houses in the vicinity with hopes that the bats will move there.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
But, yeah, they adapt quite nicely to buildings.
Let's talk about Trupp for just a couple of minutes. It's such a sweet book, and I'm curious what inspired Trupp. Trupp is an interesting character, kind of part cat.
Yes, he's a complete departure from my unloved animal genre. Trupp is I like to think he's a real species, and in the book I describe him in scientific terms like I do my other creatures.
That made me think for a minute that this is a real creature.
Exactly. I like the ambiguity of it. But he's a member of a group of sentient creatures. They look like bear cats. They grow to be quite large. When they stand on their hind legs, they could stand over 6 feet tall and weigh about 200 pounds. And they have very short, white, dense fur and crystal blue eyes and large round heads. They're capable of language, and they have opposable thumbs and have quite a complex society, very excellent herbal healers. These creatures are called fuzz heads by humans because humans can't speak the fuzz head language and address them by their proper name. Oftentimes, I've noticed that we have the same pattern with groups of American Indians, flat heads, black feet. That's not what these people called themselves. And so the fuzz head is the term that I use to just reflect that pattern. pattern of not bothering to learn a language or a culture.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
Yeah. And because these creatures are very complex and sentient, over the millennia, they live all over the planet. They've had varying experiences with humans, and over time they've become extremely reclusive.
Mm-hmm.
And so these stories are centered around their encounters with humans. I started drawing these characters back in the early 1980s.
Hmm.
And so I was given an opportunity to do a story involving them, and I am going to do another one after I work on the cockroach story.
Now, is this going to make us love cockroaches?
Well,
or just
I think
understand
my level
them.
Of expectation is more that people will hopefully say excuse me before they squish them. But it's just another way to look at them.
Yeah.
And they're an extremely successful design, very amazing insects. For a model, I chose the scientific name is wonderful, Glabrous gigantea. And it's also called a giant wood cockroach and is native to Central America and southern Mexico. And they're very large and look almost like a mantis more than a cockroach. And I think they're quite attractive. But
now, do you have a biology background? Or
I have always loved science and biology. I'm self-taught with my art and my study. Once I got out of high school, I went into a free form. I'm always reading and studying, and all patterns, life forms have interested me, and so I just collect everything I can on the subjects and just read.
Mm-hmm.
It's my favorite thing to do, and the more I read, the more fascinated I am. I'm always afraid of losing my perspective and, oh, these bugs are just great.
That's funny. What are you reading right now?
Oh, actually, I'm doing a lot of reading about the Amazon area, the jungles, and maybe possibly doing some projects to do with that.
Mm-hmm.
That's an endlessly fascinating realm. But anything. I love to subscribe to, there's some wonderful magazines, one called Nature, which keeps up with what's going on in the world's labs, science, biology, astronomy. It's a wonderful magazine. So I find myself reading a lot of nonfiction.
Well, I sure appreciate having you on. It's just been a delight. As I said, we love Stella Luna and Trupp, and I need to check out Birdie. I need to find that tomorrow.
Yes, yeah. He's a green tree python.
Oh.
Native to Papua New Guinea.
Interesting.
And I fell in love with that particular creature from visiting the San Diego Zoo. They're an absolutely beautiful, marvelous snake.
Well, I must read it to get over my fear of snakes.
Well, I always hope that it does shift people's fear, because fear is connected to dislike and therefore disrespect of a species. And if you know, any of the books that I write help people to appreciate a species more, I'd be overjoyed.
Yes, well, Janelle Cannon, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
You're welcome, and good luck.
All right, take care.
Oh, a good show, I think. Next week, my guest will be Eric Marcus, author of Vegan. If you have any comments about Writers on Writing, please email me at bdemarcob@aol.com or write to me in care of the station, P.O. Box 4362, Irvine, 92616. The show is also internet accessible at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, KUCI, 88.9 FM in Irvine. You've heard Etta James, you've heard Charles Rutherford's All-Star Jazz Ensemble, and you've heard, well, featuring Brian Barrett, and we'll close with a blues tune by Brian Barrett. Chris is on next with Music for Lunch Pails. Take care, and thank you so much for listening, and get back to work. Remember, it's all about writing like there's no tomorrow.